thing that you can remember?
I can remember pretty well when I was about 1 year old. I remember a few things that happened when I was about 1 year old.
Do you really?
No.
Yes, when I moved, I can remember that we moved up to the prairie, as we called it, when I was 1 year old. And we stayed all night in a deserted house on the way. We was moving with wagon and team. And we got a little old butter mold, and along later years, I had that in the family for many years after that, and I can just faintly remember some of that, the place that we stayed all night. That's about the one of the things that I can remember.
Well, now, where were you born?
I was born in the little town of McLean, Oklahoma, that was Indian Territory in those days, and that's about 20 miles south of Muskogee, Oklahoma.
Was Indian Territory different than other places?
Well, there was no state laws. It was all governed by the Indians. They had some kind of a tribal government that they... And, of course, the hanging judge from Fort Smith, he was the main law and order. He took all the criminals to Fort Smith, Arkansas, and hung them.
Everybody?
Well... He hung more men than any man, I guess, that ever lived. I have his history of his book in there, The Hanging Judge, they called him.
And did you know him later?
No, never knew him. Never knew him.
Well, what's the next thing you remember?
Well, of course, I remember moving up to this place, and it was bare country. There wasn't even a barbed wire fence there. But it was the land that my father had filed on through the Dawes Commission. He went to Muskogee, Oklahoma before the Dawes Commission and took his father and witnesses to prove that he was an Indian, and became an enrollee on the record of the Dawes Commission. And they gave him a number, and they gave me a number. And he filed on this land there. There was 280 acre pieces. I got 80 and he got 80. And when we moved there, there wasn't even a barbed wire fence. And for many years, 4 or 5 years after that, why, we could still see the tracks where the wagons cut through the mud to bring the lumber in to build a house and a barn, and we moved there.
How old were you when you moved there?
I was 1 year old.
1 year old.
I was 1 year old when I came there. Yeah.
Do you remember what that place looked like?
Oh yes, because we built it up from scratch, and I lived there then till we was married. I went to the Navy. I was still living at that place when I went to the Navy. I went off to college, to Bacon College. That's an Indian college at Muskogee, Oklahoma.
At what age?
At 17. But I got interested in serving my country, and I left my college and went and joined the Navy. And
what year was that?
That was in 1918. And I went back then. I was sent to the Naval Training Station at Great Lakes, Illinois. Went through boot camp there, and I became interested in radio. And I transferred from a seaman to the radio school and became a radio operator. And later on, I was transferred from there to Philadelphia. And I was an instructor in radio school in the Parkway Building in Philadelphia when the armistice was signed.
And then how long was it before you got married?
We married while we was in the Navy.
What year was that?
1918.
That was 1918. I came home on a furlough and we got married. And I was married when the war was over.
Well, now you came to California in 1924, is that correct?
That's right.
What happened in those years between 1918 and 1924?
We married, and my father and mother left this farm and moved to a town, Nowata, Oklahoma, which was about 20 miles from there.
Nowata.
N-O-W-A-T-A. It's the county seat of Nowata County. And we decided to farm because I had my 80 acres and then I was to rent my father's. And in the meantime, he had acquired another 80 acres there. He bought it. So we had three 80s there together. So I tried farming for a year or two, and I did all right at it, as far as that's concerned. I had good equipment, good horses, good tools, and all this, that, and the other.
That your father had left you?
Left me, and I bought some of it. And my wife got an allotment out of my pay, and she didn't get the check till we got home. And we used that money to buy a new wagon. I remember that real well.
How much did that wagon cost?
Oh, about $100. About $100, yeah. Well, anyway, we lived there then. But my mother always, she said, well, now, my wife was about as big as a bar of soap after a hard day's washing. And she says, well, now, you'll never... she'll never be able to do the things out here on this farm that I do, and I think you ought to consider getting off of this farm and doing something else. Well, my father had been what's called a Raleigh retailer. He had that in the adjoining county over there.
A Raleigh retailer, is that like a salesman?
Yeah. They sell they go from house to house and sell well, they sell extracts and spices and medicines, like the liniments and ointments and stuff like that, you know. And then they sold stock food and poultry food and all that kind of stuff. Well, they insisted that I get into that. So I got over in the adjoining county, which was Craig County, and I tried that for about 2 or 3 years. And I did, I could sell it all right. It was no problem to sell it. But the company kept saying, oh, these farmers are all honest. They'll take care of you. You don't have to worry about it. You just sell it. Well, I sold it, of course, but when the panic hit, why, I had out several $1,000 in Oklahoma, and every farmer in the country nearly owned me because I went far and near. And
well, now, when you say the panic, what panic is that?
Well, when the depression started, you know.
When was that?
That was in about 23. The farmers back there, a lot of them, you know, they couldn't pay their taxes. They had some bad years, and they just couldn't. And I had men come to me and say, well, Grandma, I sure would like to have another bottle of that liniment, but I just simply can't pay my bill now, but I'll get it some way, and I'd give him another bottle, and that'd just put me in that much worse. Well, finally, in 1924, we realized that we couldn't make it, and her folks was out here, and they were all doing good in California.
Good in what way?
In financial way, they were all getting along good.
Were they farmers?
Some of them had farms, some of them working on farms. Her brother worked in the post office here. Well, anyway, they wanted her to come to California. They said, we'll pay your way to California if you'll come out here and visit us. So while I was still back there, and she came to California. Well, during that time, we made up our mind, or I did, that I was going to collect all I could get out of that, and was going to do the best we could. We owned her home back there, and... I called her and I said, well, how would you like to move to California? And she said, well, she would like it. She thought that is the thing for us to do. So I said, well, I'm going to sell out back here. We're going to have a sale and sell all we've got, and we're coming to California. Well, she was out here and she had two children with her. And they wanted her to stay out here and let me do all the selling and come out here. But she told her mother and her sisters, they all lived right here in this town. She's a member of a family of 16 children, 8 boys and 8 girls, born to the same father and the same mother. And for a long time, There was 12 of them lived right here in this immediate vicinity. Well, anyway, she told them, she says, no, I'm going back there and help Clarence sell out, and then we'll come back. But you can keep the children, if you will, and they won't have to make the trip. So that's what we did, and we went back there and had her sale and sold out, and we paid all of her debts and left Oklahoma practically broke.
Now, you sold the farm?
We had sold the farm, yes, and bought this town, this house and town, and built a barn, a good big barn on it, and a room, a storage room on this barn to put all this products that I ordered.
You had that many products?
Oh yes. We had a big store full of them there, and then I carried them. I used a wagon and team first, and then I finally got a car, a Model T car with a back end to haul them in, and that way I'd come in more often. When I had my wagon and team, I'd go out for a week at a time and live with just stay all night with the farmers, and they'd put my team up and feed it, and next morning, why, I'd, how much do you for staying all night? Well, oh, we won't charge you anything or something like that. Maybe some of them would say, well, $1.50, and I'd give them $1.50 worth of liniment or something like that, and I take that much off of their bill, and that's where we live. But later on then, when we discarded the horses and the wagon, why, we got in the car, and that way I had to come in twice a week anyway. So that's the way we
did. How old were you at that time?
Well, I was 23 years old then. You see, I stay up with the years. When in 1924, I was 24 years old when I came to California.
Do you remember how much money you would make in a good year at that when you were 22?
Well, we lived all right and got along good, but as far as making money, I just made a living.
What would that be?
Well, I don't know. That wasn't much in those days. We kept no books. We just kind of lived from. We had a little bank account, all right, but sometimes it was pretty low, and we just kind of lived from day to day.
Would you say you made $200 or $300 a year?
Oh, more than that. Oh, yes, we made more than that, sure. It took more than that to run our car. Of course, gasoline is about 15 cents a gallon. And I remember when we got to Bakersfield, we run out of oil. We brought a can of oil with us, a 5-gallon can of oil. Now, we used 5-gallon of oil coming from Oklahoma in the Model T. But we got to Bakersfield, and we was out of oil, and we had to buy a quart of oil. And he says, do you want Western or do you want Eastern? Well, that's the first time I'd ever heard that term. Back there, we just had oil, period. And I guess it's all Eastern oil. I don't know. I said, well, how much is it? Well, he says, I'm pretty sure that this is right. He told me the Western was 15 cents a quart. But I think the other was about 20. So I bought the Western and put one quart of oil in, and that got me to Lindsay.
How much money did you have when you got here?
We had about less than $5 when we got here.
And that was more than it would be today, but still that's not a lot of money.
No. I got here about 10 o'clock at night, and I stayed all night with this sister that is living right down here now that called me on the phone a little bit ago. Stayed all night at her place, and the next day I looked around the country and made some acquaintances, and I went down to a man by the name of Morris Gifford. He run the Lindsay Feed and Fuel. He had a trucking business. And her brother worked for him. And so he said, well, I understand you're going to be looking for a job. I said, yes, I'm looking for one right now. And he said, well, I'm going to hire you. He said, I'm going to have one for you, a driving truck. But he said, now it'll probably be a couple of weeks before I can start you to work. But he says just as soon as the oranges start, they start picking oranges, why, you can go to work. And I said, well, that's fine. So I just spent that one day. And that night I went out to her father and mother's, and we stayed all night. They lived out here 3 or 4 miles in the country. And so he said, well, he says, how would you like to go help me pick grapes? He says, I'm picking grapes out here for a man. And he says, he needs some more pickers. And I said, yes, I'll go with you, sure. So that morning we got up about 6 o'clock, I guess, and we was getting around there and getting some lunches ready to take out there. And this brother-in-law's wife came out to the house. She says, Clarence, the boy that's driving the other truck, he had an accident. Said he dropped a big lump of coal on his... we sold coal and hay and wood and all that kind of stuff. And feed, too. But he dropped a lump of coal and mashed his foot off. And he says, they want you to go to work.
Mashed his foot off?
Mashed his foot badly. Mashed his foot badly. And he couldn't work. So at 7 o'clock that morning, I went on the job the next morning. And
Did you have any prior experience driving trucks?
Oh, yes, I had. Yes, I had driven. And like I told you before, I'm a jack of all trades. I'm a pretty good carpenter. I'm a pretty good painter. I'm a pretty good electrician. And I've done everything in my life, practically. So
all the good things.
Well, and some of the bad things, too. But anyway, I went down there and went to work on the truck. And from that day till the day I retired in the post office, over 35 years later, I had never been off the payroll a single day except Sunday. I drove that truck till I got a job out here on a ranch, and the man laid me off he laid me off because he run out of work. But in the meantime, I hired to another truck driver. And it just worked that away, from one job to the other. If I'd lose one, why, till I went to work in the post office. And, of course, then I worked 35 years in the post office. But during that time, I went to work for 50 cents an hour when I started. And
50 cents an hour driving truck?
Driving truck, yeah. The first day I hauled about 25 ton of sacked Milo. I hauled a load from out in the country to the Porterville Poultry Association and unloaded that. I went back and got another load and brought it to this feed and fuel. He had a branch place in Strathmore. So I unloaded it there, and then I went back and got the third load.
When you say unloaded it, you didn't unload it by hand, did you?
Yes, we unloaded it by hand.
By yourself?
No, a man out on the ranch helped me load it. And then a man at each place helped me unload it, see. But I handled it. I took it off the truck and put it out there, and they stacked it on dollies and drove it.
So you weren't just driving truck. You were loading it.
Oh, I was on it. Yes, sir. It wasn't just driving. It was doing everything. And I'm telling you, when night came, I was dragging. But I stayed with it, and I made the man... I guess I made him a good man, because even after I went work part-time in the post office, why, he would still say, well, I've got some odd jobs I wish you'd do for me if you'd get a little time off.
Well, how long would one of your days go?
10 hours, at least. And lots of days, as much as 12 hours. I worked by the hour, and just whatever hours I got in. And every day, this man was very strict. He had me to keep a record of what I did all the time. If I drove 20 miles to Hanford to pick up a load of feed, why, he wanted me to show the time on the clock from the time I left Lindsay till I got to the place. And you used the 45 minutes loading a load of feed, and then you drove back to Lindsay, and that's the day I turned in this report. And he paid me for the time that I put in on that deal.
How did you come to find out about the post office?
Well, this brother, her brother, worked in the post office. And by that time, I had made a real good friend out here on Olive Ranch, El Torre's Olive Ranch. They had 110 acres of olives, and they had about 80 or 90 acres of oranges. And I hauled the fruit out there off of that. And this man took a liking to me, and he needed a ranchman. So he said to me one day, he said, "You know," he said, "how'd you like to have a job by the month?" He says, I'd like to hire you by the month out here, and I'll furnish you a house and your water and your lights. And I've got a cow here. You can milk that cow, and you can get your milk." And of course, we had children too that come along, and that was interesting too, you know. And we could go to school then.
How many children?
Well, we had two children then. We have three children, but one of them we had later after that. After I was working in the post office study then.
And what year was this we're talking about?
Well, that was about 25 or, let's see, that was in 25 when we got out on the ranch. And so I said, well, I wouldn't quit this man. I said, we have an agreement that I give him 30 days notice, and he'll give me 30 days notice. And I said, I couldn't leave him without a notice. And I said, I'm pretty well satisfied with the job. And he said, well, he says, I've already talked to him. He said, I want to hire you. And he said he wouldn't stand in the way if you want to do it. And I said, well, I might consider it. So anyway, we made the deal. And on the first day of January, I moved out to the ranch and took a job on the ranch. And while I was there, this brother-in-law said, well, we're holding a examination for a job in the post office, and I think you ought to take it. And I said, well, I'll consider it. So I thought about it a few days, and so one morning I said to the gentleman out, the manager of the ranch, I told him, I said, I want to go into the town and take this civil service examination today. And I said, I'll get up early, and I'll put in a day's work, but I'll also take a couple or 3 hours to go down to take this examination. And I had already taken the civil service examination in Oklahoma for the Railway Mail Service when I was back there. And I passed that, and I was on the eligible list for the Railway Mail Service in Oklahoma when we came out here. But of course, being out here, why, they never did call me to go to work back there. Well, he told me, he said, don't worry about the ranch. He says, if you want to take that job, that examination, you go on down. But I got up early that morning, and at daylight, I was out driving the tractor. And I worked till about 8:30, and went in, took a bath, and went down to the bank. They had this this examination in the back of the bank. And there was about 12 or 15 took the examination that morning. And there was eight of us passed. And there was one girl, she worked in the bank. She had the highest grade, and I had the second highest grade of the bunch that passed. Some of them didn't pass. And so it wasn't long after that till they said, well, now we'd like for you to take a job in the post office. And the reason we can't take this girl, we want a clerk carrier. We want somebody to carry. Well, in those days, why, a man was all that carried mail. Of course, in this day, why, they got some girls out of carrying, ladies out of carrying mail. But in those times, why, men just carried the mail. So I got the job in the post office. And it was a part-time job. It was, some days it'd be 4 hours, and some days it'd be, well, it could be 8 hours carrying and 2 hours clerking. So that's when I started in the post office.
How much money did you get?
We got, $0.75 an hour, I believe.
And you did work by the hour?
We worked by the hour. The top salary then for a clerk was $1,800. That was $150 a month. And her brother had been in there, and he was getting top salary, and everybody thought he was rich, of course, because he got $150 a month. But that's when I started in. And then because I didn't get full time, I had to supplement my income. So I got a job in a store. And this store was a seven-day Advent store. And they always kept it open on Sunday. And on Saturday, they always wanted me to no work on Saturday at all. From sundown Friday till sundown Saturday, there was absolutely no work. And this was a big store. It had furniture, and it had all kinds of big grocery, and had an adjoining meat market. And they finally put in a line of shoes, too.
That was here in town?
That is right here in town. And this lady, she was the main one of it. Of course, her father and mother was in it, too. But she was the manager of the whole outfit. So she just put me a time book up there, and I kept my own time. And then when she told me, she said, "Now, any time that you're not working in the post office, you come down here. There's always work to do." Because in those days, we kept a big storeroom out there, and there was always sweeping to do. There was potatoes to sack. There was sugar to sack and sweep the store, and I could always find something to do. And she just turned the storeroom over to me. She said, "I've never had a good storeroom out there. We get 10 cases of corn covered up with 10 of tomatoes, and pretty soon I order 20 cases of corn, and I've got 10, and so I redone that whole storeroom, and I worked in there lots of times till it took me a month or two to get that thing really organized and wait on customers like I did. Every time I had a little time, I'd put it in the storeroom. So that's the way I worked. And I worked 8 years in the post office before I got a regular appointment. And in that time, well, finally, a postal inspector came down one time. And he says, "Graham," he says, "I've looked over your record here," and he says, "we're going to try to give you a regular job out of this." And so he went into all the figures, and they made a recommendation to the department, but turned it down. Said there wasn't enough work to give me a full time. Although lots of days I'd put in 12 hours but some days I'd only get in 3 or 4. See. And they was using me everywhere. They was using me on the carrying, and lots of days I'd go out and carry, come in and work 2 or 3 hours on the window at noon during the relief lunch hour, and then I'd grab a sack and go out and carry again. And that's the way it worked till I got a regular appointment. And then when I got a regular appointment, it was as a clerk, not a carrier. And I worked at that for several years, and at that time, we had a good, large money order section here, and we had postal savings. We had over $100,000 in postal savings in the office, and that was carried through the postal saving through the money order section. We had one section for money orders, postal saving, and registered mail.
Yeah, you mean it was like a savings account in the bank?
Yes, yes, paid interest. Yeah, that's right. And so they came down and they said, "Well, we want the girl that had been in there, she retired. So they want somebody to take over that." And while I was one of the younger employees, and several of them had more seniority than I did and could have gotten the job if they'd wanted, it seemed that none of them wanted it because of extra responsibility, and you had to take out a bigger bond. And
on yourself,
you had to buy your own bond. So they said, "Well, Graham, what about you?" And I said, "I'm all for it." I said, "Yeah, I'd like to have it." I never was the guy to back down on anything. So I went in there, and I guess I made him a good employee because the inspectors complimented me on it, and I got along at it good. And then a few years later, why, our assistant postmaster retired, and so they said to Mr. Bandy, that is the postmaster, said, well, what about, who are you going to recommend for assistant postmaster? And he said, well, I've kind of got a problem. He says, I've got several senior employees here, but the man I want to have it is Graham. So he said, he talked it over, he took us in, he took the postmaster and I in, and had a talk with us. And he said, well, now, you're going to appoint a man here that's a junior employee. And he says, you might get into some problems unless you work this just right. He says, I'm all for it. He says, I think that's the man to have it all right. But he says, whenever he goes to telling these other boys that's been here longer than he has what to do, he says, you might get into some problems unless you back him up 100%. And he says, for everything to work, he says, you'll have to stand behind him in his decisions, even if he makes a wrong decision. Well, you stand behind him, but privately take him into your confidence and tell him he made a mistake there and he should have done so-and-so. So I told him, well, that's the only way I'd take the job anyway. I said, I realize what I'm getting into. And we did. We had some boys there that had been in lots longer than I was. It was in nearly up to retirement then. But none of them made any holler about the getting the job. So I took it over, and I got along real good. I had no problems whatsoever, and it worked out good. And I was assistant postmaster for 12 years until I retired on my birthday in 1959.
What have you done since then?
Travel. I've traveled to every state in the Union. I've made 14 trips into Mexico, and I've been three long trips into Canada. And that trailer sitting there has been to every state in the Union, I think. At least we have been. It might not have been in some, but we left it in one state and drove over into adjoining states with the car. And we have been in every state in the continental United States during that time. And we've fished, and we enjoyed Mexico, went all over the Republic, went in one time at Yuma, Arizona, and went down the west coast of Mexico, and landed in the United States again at Brownsville, Texas. We was gone from home for 10 months that trip.
How old are you now?
I'm 81 years old now.
All right, what I'd like to do now is to get you to go back to the time after you got out of the service, when you first started farming, and describe the farm to me and what kind of farming you did.
Well, naturally it was a general farm. We raised wheat and oats and corn, kefir corn, milo maize.
Kefir corn?
Kefir corn.
What's that?
Well, it's a head. It's like milo maize, only it's white instead of being red. And they grow it back in that country. And you cut it off, and it's wonderful feed for chickens. And you just throw it out in the chicken yard, and they'll pick it all off and leave the tassel that it came out of. And we had a big... In those days, we thrashed with steam thrashers, and I can even remember one time when we used horsepower. We had a team that went around and around and run this thrashing machine, but I can only remember that one time of doing that.
Was that on your farm?
That was on our farm, yes. And we cut the bands. They ground. They they cut this grain with a binder and bound it into bundles, and they tied a string on it. So in order to thresh it, you had to cut that band off of there. And we'd pitch that off, and we had a man there that every time you'd throw a bundle off, well, he'd hit it with a knife and cut that band. And then they had they fed it by hand before we had all these automatic things. But that was the beginning of it. And then we also, at that time, in that period, we drilled a well. And they drilled there for about 2 or 3 weeks, and they used a team. And the team go around and around, and that's what drilled the well.
Just how big would the pipe be?
Oh, it was a regular size well, six inch well or something like that. But as the team went around, why this walking beam dropper up, that old thing would chunk and chunk and chunk, and drilling in hard rock. But then they'd take it out, you know, and they'd build a fire and heat that bit and take sledgehammers and sharpen it up, put some new points on it so it'd hold out to the required distance so they could get a casing down in there. But anyway, then in later years, we we got the steam engines, and then they put on the automatic feeders, and that was a canvas that rolled around, and all you did was pitch the bundle on there, and we always tried to pitch with the heads forward so that the heads of the grain would hit the cylinder, the spinning cylinder down in there, and that would knock the grain out first. Where if you did it the other way, the butt end went in, it didn't do as good a job. And so then we had two men. We'd go on, one man would drive up on one side, another man would drive up on the other, and we'd pitch into that, and it had a divider in there, in the center of it. And it all went through, and then they had the big circle blowers that would make the big straw stacks. And some farmers would stay on the straw stack and walk around and stack this straw. My father always did, because we had lots of oat straw, and oat straw is very good feed for cattle. Wheat straw is not near as good as oat straw. But he always built a good stack and kept it for his cattle.
Well, now, did you say all these farmers, did they do it as collectively?
This thrashing machine would go from one farm to another, and they all joined in and helped. Every farmer helped the other one thrash. We'd have 8 bundle wagons and 4 wagons hauling to the granary, hauling the grain away, and then we'd have men out in the field that would pitch this grain up off of the ground and to the man on the wagon so he could haul it into the thrasher.
Where did these steam thrashers come from?
They were owned in the neighborhood, and they would be, they'd be 4 or 5 in maybe 10 or 15, 20 miles around there. You'd have 4 or 5 men that would own thrashers, and they'd thrash all summer long, as far as that's concerned. A man, his name was Gus Arning. I remember him real well. He thrashed all of his life, and he visited me here after I was working in the post office one time, and he brought a doctor out here with him, and they was on their way to the World's Fair in San Francisco, and that man had thrashed for my dad many, many years, and I remember that so well.
What were the people like in the 1923? Were the farmers honest people?
Oh, yes. A man in those days, his word was about as good as his note. I can remember when my father would, if he needed some money, after we got our telephones in, he'd just call up the bank and say, "Well, I'm gonna overcheck. I'm buying some cattle over here or something." "Oh, that's all right, Ed." That is my father's name, Ed Graham. He says, "We'll take care of you. Come in when you get around to it." And that's the way they were. And
people didn't cheat each other?
No. Oh, of course, you know, there's always a few bad apples in any basket, but as a usual thing, most of those farmers, they all trusted one another. They loaned each other equipment. And in this threshing, they'd always, everybody helped the other one, and they all ate. The women went to the house where they was thrashing and helped them get this big dinner for 25 or 30 men would be there for lunch, or dinner, as they called it in those days. And so the women would all go and help get this food. And it was a cooperative effort. And the farmers were, they were all hard-working people. We were all, very few tractors in those days. They all did it with horse and plows. And I walked many a day behind a team and plowed corn all day long, walking and plowing, holding the handles on that plow. And we broke all the, did all the plowing, that is the breaking where you turn the sod up over with a team. We used three horses on those and a three horse evener. That's a thing that all three horses pull on a thing, and they all pull even on it. We call it a three-horse evener. And we plowed all of our plowing with that kind of a deal.
What was your house like?
Well, we had a nice house. We had my mother was one of the most extreme housekeepers I believe I've ever known in my life. And I think my wife would bear me out in this. She was so clean that she was, it was a talk of the neighborhood, was my mother. But we did have a nice house. And I'm sorry to say, though, we didn't use it much. We took off our shoes at the door. If the shoes was a little bit muddy, we took them off the door and come in our stocking feet. And that's the way she kept her house. But we had no modern facilities. We had no water. We had outside toilets, just privies, as we call them.
You didn't use the Sears Roebuck catalog, did you?
I guess everybody did that. I guess that toilet paper was practically unknown in those days. That's right. We used newspapers. And the men, if they went around behind the barn, why, maybe they used a couple of red cobs and a white cob. That's kind of off the record, but then that's the truth, all right, just the same. But we had lots of good times. We had, the farmers would get a day off now and then. They'd all get out and have a rabbit hunt and kill all the rabbits. And we killed lots of ducks, and we caught fish, and game laws in Oklahoma was unknown in those days. I'm sorry to say this, but there were some men back there that even poisoned the ducks for just their feathers to make feather beds out of. But I had an uncle in Oklahoma. His name was Gid Graham, and he became a state senator, and that is one of his things that he was known. I've got a book in there that he wrote.
What was his name again?
His name was Gid Graham.
Gid?
Gid Graham. Senator Gid Graham.
You're going to have to spell that for me.
G-R-A-H-A-M.
No, the first name.
Gid. His name was Gideon, but his G-I-D, we always... His name was Gideon Graham, but then we always called him Uncle Gid.
Uh-huh.
Well, he sponsored the game laws, and when he died, he had the quails, the Bob White quails. He had them mounted and all over his house, and he had lots of wild game mounted and put in his house. But he got the game laws to where they couldn't do all that. They had to have limits and seasons, and he sponsored all that and did a good job of it for the hunters and the fishermen in Oklahoma.
Now, I remember you telling me about a coal deal. What was that? How did that get started?
Well, this Craig County was adjoined Kansas. And there was a coal company that came back from, came out there from Pennsylvania, and they used core drills. They drilled a little core about 2 inches in circumference.
This was in 1923?
Yes, 22 and 23. They started in 22 testing some. But they drilled for this coal down, and they brought these little samples out to the top and used this core drill. And in the long run, they finally found coal all over that country back there. And thousands and thousands and thousands of acres, they bought the coal right on it for $60 an acre. And when they closed that deal in at the county seat, it was one of the largest money transactions that had ever been made in the state of Oklahoma. Most of these farmers had their land mortgaged, and at that time they were in bad shape financially. Many farms were closed and foreclosed on, and banks were land poor. They had more land than they knew what to do with, so this was a great thing for that country, because they used this money to pay off these mortgages and back taxes and things of that nature, and it set these farmers up again with a clear bill of sale, so to speak, and they could make their ground and farm the top land, and without being heavily mortgaged and having to pay a lot of interest and back taxes and things of that nature.
So that coal company came in, and for a fairly small amount of money, large in total, but a fairly small amount of money when the people needed money, they made a pretty good investment.
Oh, yes. And now that was in 22 and 23 and 24 that they did that. And up to this present time, they've never taken out any of that deep coal. Now, Oklahoma does have a top strata of coal in it that has been there ever since I've known anything about it. We always burn coal, and lots of times we just go over to a place where we knew where this coal was, and we just go over there, and in a day, we could dig us enough coal to last a month or two. And we'd go over there with a team and wagon and pick and shovel and maybe a stick or two of dynamite to break a big rock if there was one in the way, and it wasn't over 6 or 8 feet of dirt down to this coal, and we could go over there and dig us a bunch of coal in one day. And then lots of men, they dug for the whole country. They had it to sell, and that was one of the things that country was noted for, was cheap fuel.
Do you know how they dug these mines? Did you ever have any dealings with it so that you wouldn't?
Oh, I've dug coal myself. I went over me and a friend of mine. We dug our own coal. We go over there, and like I say, in 1 or 2 days, we get out enough coal, and we did it ourselves just with a pick and shovel.
How did you do it?
Well, you just you find a place where it's been dug, or they've already, you are along a creek or something, where there's a wash, and you just dig the dirt and throw it back, and the next time then you just dig over a few little bit 3 feet further and dig that 3 feet off and throw that dirt back over where you have already taken the coal out of, and it worked. It wasn't too hard. You could do it. It's real easy. And then when you get down to the coal, you clean it off nice, and then you call it pinning out. You drive pins through it with a sledgehammer, and it breaks out in big lumps, and you just throw them on your wagon, and then if any of it breaks off in small stuff, you just take your shovel and shovel that in too. It's all good coal. And that's the way we got the coal.
And it was good coal.
Oh, it's good coal, you betcha. It was what we call soft coal. It wasn't the hard coal, but there was two kinds of coal there. There was black coal, and there was red coal. And most people like to get the red coal because there's less soot in it. It didn't make as hot a fire as the black coal, but Everybody, most people like it, especially for the cook stoves.
Was there a layer of what you call slack around it?
Yes, slate. Yeah, there was some slate on it, and you'd take that slate off, too.
Was that any good?
No, we didn't use it. Just pitch it off. Yeah, there was usually a little slate on top of the coal.
About 6 inches?
Yeah, something like that. Maybe in some places only 2 inches. And we didn't like to have any more than we had to have, because that is kind of hard to work off, too. But you would split that off, and when you drove your pins in, if you had just a little bit, you just drive your pins in and then throw your slate off and then take your coal out.
Did you take your coal out in little pieces or in big chunks?
Oh, we got it out in big chunks. Sometimes it's about all one person could lift. It'll lift a chunk of coal. We like to get it out in big chunks as much as we could.
Did you ever blow it out?
No, we never blew it. Never did. We used the pins and pinned it out.
What do these pins look like?
Oh, just an iron wedge of a thing with a sharp point on them, and just drive them down through there. And as you drive down through, well, it'll crack and make big chunks of it.
You didn't have to go down underground to get this out.
Oh, no. This is just, they'd run over 6 or 8 feet of dirt on top of it. We just took it off, and we went right down to the coal.
Did you ever hear, when people sold it, do you remember how much they got for it?
Yes. A man that I know of one man that he for years he hauled this coal, and he could go out in a day, and he could get 25 bushel of coal. He'd get out 25 bushel of coal, and load it in his wagon and take it to town that night and unload it where he'd sold it. Next morning he'd go out, and the next day he'd dig in 25 bushel and come in. He got $5 for that.
25 bushel.
25 bushel. He got $5 worth for that load of coal.
How much,
delivered.
How much would that weigh? I'm not familiar with the bushel.
I really don't know how much that would weigh.
How big's a bushel?
Well, a bushel of coal is. I'll tell you, we used to have every farmer back there used to have what we called a half a bushel, and they used it for everything. They used a half a bushel of coal and a half a bushel of wheat and a half a bushel. And if you bought wheat from your neighbor or borrowed it, lots of times the one farmer would run out of, oats. We fed most of our horses oats because oats is a better feed for horses than hard corn or wheat. Wheat's a good grain for hogs, but not for horses. And if one farmer would run out of oats, well, he'd borrow 25 bushel from his neighbor till he thrashed. And he would measure it in these half a bushels.
Is a half a bushel like a bucket?
Yeah, it's a bucket.
It's about the size of a milk bucket?
No, it's a good size. It's bigger than a milk bucket.
Like a water bucket, maybe.
Yeah, it's a big water bucket. But they used it for everything, and they'd put this wheat in, then they'd take a straight edge and just level full, and they'd stand there and count it and pour it in and make a mark, you know, on the wall or somewhere.
Would it be like a 5-gallon bucket?
Yes, about like a 5-gallon bucket, only it's round.
Okay,
It's round.
I can see that.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing it was.
What about what kind of food did people eat in those days?
Well, I'll tell you, people, they raised what they ate and ate what they raised, mostly. We raised our own potatoes. We raised our own roastineers. It was cabbage. We had a family orchard. We had apples, peaches, gooseberries, Concord grapes. We sprayed our own trees with a hand sprayer.
You had grapes in Oklahoma?
Yes, yeah. We had them right on our farm.
Was that common?
Well, a few. There's lots of grapes in the adjoining state in Arkansas. They have lots of Concord grapes in Arkansas. They sell them in a basket, about 5-pound baskets.
Were they cultivated as they're cultivated here?
No, nothing like it. Uh-huh. It's a different process altogether.
Could you describe it?
Well, we did these Concord grapes. We did grow them on a trellis and a wire. We had them along the back fence of our garden, And we didn't have any to sell. We just used them for grape juice and jelly and little jam and stuff like that. But they were real good. They're slip skin grapes. And they got a seed in them. And every time you put a grape in your mouth, why, you spit out the seed and the skin. But they were wonderful for jelly and grape juice. In fact, the business in our travels back in Michigan, the Welch grape juice people, they have a place back there where they have thousands of acres of Concord grapes, and they grow back there. California don't grow any Concord grapes, and I don't know why, but they've experimented with them, and they've tried to cross them with other things, but they never have been able to use them much in California. They don't fit into our climate and culture out here for some reason.
Did they make wine or alcoholic beverages with them?
No, I don't know that I ever heard of any of that. There was lots of moonshining in Oklahoma.
How did that work?
Well, they, of course, they'd set out in the boondock somewhere or slip around and set this mash, and they'd use wheat and barley and a little bit of everything. They could put apricots in it, and then they'd ferment it.
That's for the mash?
Yeah, and they fermented that, and they let it ferment for a few days, and then they'd take this water.
What's fermenting like?
Well, it works. It's like making vinegar. You put apples in and take the apple juice, and it works. There's something about it that it ferments and makes vinegar out of this apple juice.
How would they set it? Would they put it in a barrel?
They put it in barrels, wooden barrels, not metal barrels. You had to have wooden barrels to put your mash in. And then they'd take they'd put so much water in there, and then after it got to the right place where it had the alcohol in it, then they'd take it out and distill it, get the alcohol out of it.
How did they distill it?
Well, most of the times they had a copper wash boiler that they'd welded some pipes on, and they put a fire under this wash boiler and started it to steaming, and as this steam came out, then they run it through a cold water, a tank that had cold water in, and that'd bring it back to a liquid, and that's where they would get their alcohol.
And this wash boiler, that's part of a washing process?
Yeah, but they put coils in it. See, they took this copper wash boiler because that is one thing they had. Every woman back there in those days had a wash boiler to boil her clothes in. They didn't wash in those days like they do now. There's no hand washers, so they used washboards. They rubbed it on a washboard, and then in those days they always put those clothes in and boiled them after that, and that's what they used the copper boiler for. So they every hardware store in the country had copper boilers. So these men that needed bootlegging or was in the bootleg business, that is an easy thing for them to buy, and they could put this top on and screw it down with some to hold it with some clamps to keep that steam from blowing the top off. And they did sometimes, if they wasn't careful, there was some men that got scalded pretty bad and blew the thing up. But they knew how to do it, and they had a copper coils down in that wash boiler where that thing boiled and made it into that vapor that come out, and then they finally turned it into alcohol.
Now that was what they drank, the liquid?
That's what they drank.
The liquid that came out?
That's what they drank.
How strong was that?
Well, it was plenty strong. You better have something that you can take after it, or it'll burn your throat. It's just too strong, really. And the trouble of it is, if they let it age a while, it wouldn't have been so bad, but most of them, they didn't let it age. They used it in 2 or 3 weeks or a month.
What did the aging do to it?
It moistens it, and then, well, it makes it better. Any liquor, you know, is the more age you can get on it. Now, you take tequila in Mexico, they age that. And I've tasted this raw stuff right out of the still where it's coming out. And, boy, that's just like drinking pepper sauce. But you let it age a while, and it gets to where you can drink it, I guess, if you like it.
So it mellows out.
Yeah, it does. It does. That's right.
Was that a fairly typical thing for people to make moonshine?
There was a lot of moonshine made in Oklahoma. Like I say, those farmers got in straits back there financially, and that was one way that they some of them reclaim their farms. I know of one man there. His name was Bible, and he was a very fine man. Everybody thought he was a good man, and he was an honest, upright man. I don't think he drank. I don't think he smoked, and he was a religious man as far as that's concerned. But he was in financial straits, so he started moonshining, and they finally caught him and took him to jail, and he said, "Well, I've got my farm paid off now." He said, "I can go back and I can live without this now." He said, "I'll farm my farm now." But he says, "I was in debt so bad that if I hadn't done this, I was going to lose my farm." And he had they found out that he had a lot of his barrels that he put this mash in down in a tunnel in under his hog pen. And that way you couldn't smell this mash. As it ferments, it gives off quite an odor. And the men, the prohibition agents, they could smell it a mile, they said. So he took care of that by putting this under his pig pen, and he got away with it.
This is session one, tape number two, of an interview with Mr. Clarence W. Graham for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 755 Valencia Street, Lindsay, California, 93247, on March 18, 1981, at 9 a.m. Well, I'd like now to go on and talk about your business, and I know that you traveled like a traveling salesman, and maybe some of the experiences you had with the farmers that you met and what life was like on the farms.
Well, of course, as I say, I drove a team and for a long time, and the farmers were, most of them were just dirt farmers. They worked in the fields and done most of their own work. Very few of them had hired men. They done most of their own work.
Were they glad to see you?
Most of them were always glad to see me, and I sold stock food for their horses. The ones that had the better farmers had good stock, and they fed them worm medicine and stock food that, just like people are taking vitamins, they give them to their horses. And the same way with their chickens and poultry, they had to keep disinfectant to keep the mites off of them, and they had to chicken food for the roup, which was a disease that a lot of chickens had in those days. It's nothing more than a cold in chickens. And I had a remedy for it. It was a good one, and that was one of the things that they used. And
did they ask your advice about problems they were having?
Oh, yes. And I had books from the W.T. Raleigh Company that explained all that. And I became a kind of a veterinarian to a certain degree. I couldn't practice it, but I knew what was good, but the company was what told me these things.
So they looked forward to you for more than their products.
That's right, they did, and I supplied them, and if I was a little late of getting around, why, they'd sometimes call me up or write me a card and ask me when I was coming, that they needed such and such a thing. And then sometimes I would make special trips. But staying with the farmers, I found out how they lived, and they were all hard workers. A lot of them would get up long before daylight every morning, and they would work till sundown, and then lots of times they'd eaten their supper, which we called in those days, which we now call dinner, they call it supper. They'd be eating their supper about 7 or 8 o'clock, and they wouldn't anymore get the last bite down until they'd go to bed about 9 o'clock. And they'd be up the next morning at 5, some of them as much as 4:30. I stayed all night with a man one time, and I pulled in there, and his wife told me to take out my team, and I asked if I could stay all night, and she said yes. And her husband was out in the field shucking corn. So I took out my team and put them in the barn and took care of a few chores for the day around my products and got them in order for the next day. And about that time, he came in with a double sideboard load of corn. He came over and shook hands with me and greeted me and said, "Well," he says, "I'll pull this corn in here to the crib and take the team out, and then I've got to unload this corn." So I told him, I said, "Well, I'll help you unload your corn." So I started shoveling his corn, and of course they had in those days, I don't know whether you know what a scoop board is or not, but they had a scoop board in their wagon, and that was a sliding board that set up on the back end of the wagon and slid and went down in it, so you could start your shovel easy. Otherwise, you couldn't, in corn, you couldn't get down that shovel, couldn't get started shoveling. So you'd shovel off of that scoop board. So by the time he got his wagon unloaded, by the time he got his horses taken care of, I had his wagon about a third unloaded. So he got up in there then, and we both shoveled till we unloaded the wagon. And then he had 4 or 5 cows to milk, and so I said, "Well, give me a bucket. I can milk cows." And he all did it by hand, you know, no milking machines in those days. So he gave me a bucket, and he said, "Well, now, that cow there, that's a good easy cow to milk." So I just sat down, I milked that cow. So I milked about 2 of his cows while he milked 4. Then he had He took the milk to the house, and he run it through a DeLaval separator.
A DeLaval?
A DeLaval separator, ground it by hand, or turned it by hand, and he separated all that milk, took the cream out of it, and then we took the milk, and he took it out, and I followed along with him. I was interested in seeing what was going on, too. Of course, I'd been through this before. I knew it from, that's the way we used to do it. But anyway, he took this milk out to the pig pen and gave it to the pigs and kept the cream. Well, anyway, it was after dark, and we were still out of doing around with a lantern. But finally he said, "Well, supper's ready." So we went in and ate our supper. And
do you remember what you had for supper?
I don't remember, but those folks were good. They were good feeders. But they were just, it was just cornbread and beans and homegrown pork. A lot of them lived on pork. They grew their own hogs. And that is about what we had, as I remember. But might have had some pie. They were good people. They lived good. And so about 9 o'clock, he said, "Well, let's better go to bed." So we went to bed, and the next morning we got up. I heard him get up, and it must have been about 4 o'clock. It is black dark. And in a few minutes, I got up too. And what we was out and had those cows all milked and was back in there for breakfast, and it still wasn't daylight. And by sunup, he was ready to go to work. So, but he told me, he says, "I carried 2 big satchels with a lot of these products in them. And I would take them in, and they'd fold out like that. And there it laid. And I, of course, I sold bottled extracts and all kinds of spices. And then in one case, I had medicines. I had liniment and ointments and all kinds of stuff like that, and aspirins and, well, just a general line of
traveling drugs
that you could buy without no prescription, of course. So I took those in, and they bought a liberal supply of stuff from me. And so I said, well, how much do I owe you for my nice lodging? He said, well, brother, you don't owe me anything. He said, you did enough work here. Said, I ought to pay you, he said. But anyway, we...
you made yourself welcome.
Yeah, we did, and I enjoyed it, and they bought a nice bill of goods, and I went on my way rejoicing, and that was, I believe, one of the last times I was ever at his place to stay all night. Later on, I became, I did away with the horses and used the car, and I never, he was way up by the Kansas line, is a long ways from home, and I usually didn't get up there anymore, only just to with the car, and I'd drive back home at night then.
Do you remember how much your car cost you when you bought it?
Well,
was it new?
Yes, it was new. I bought two or three new cars. I would say that it cost around $600.
Was that a lot of money?
It was in those days, yeah. And getting back to the car, when I decided to leave the, when I decided to give up the Raleigh business, I sold out to another man. And I had this car, and I didn't have it paid for. I bought it on payments. So he had an old Model T, and he gave me that for my equity in the new car. And that's the car that we drove to California. It took us 8 days and eight nights to come to, from there to Lindsay, California. And we drove lots of nights till 10 o'clock at night. And we made about 30, we averaged about 35 miles an hour on the trip.
Well, when you were traveling, how often would you stop? I mean, when you were traveling as a salesman, how many stops would you make in an average day?
Well, I used to try to make at least 10 stops a day. And that would, lots of times, of course, you'd stop at some and they'd say, no, we don't need anything today. We don't need anything. And I'd name over a few things, and sometimes they would say, oh, yes, I should have so-and-so. But lots of times, why, I'd say, well, okay, if you don't need anything, why, I'll just go on. So that I'd go on, but lots of stops, I'd be there in an hour and a half, 2 hours. And sometimes we'd go out to their chicken pen, or we'd go out to the hog pen and look at their hogs and talk about things of that nature.
What kind of livestock problems did they have in those days?
Well, of course, one of the main things in those days were worms in hogs. Now, those worms gets into a hog, and the hog will live all right, but he just don't get along very good.
Is this trichinosis?
No, it isn't that. It isn't that. It isn't tapeworm.
Uh-huh.
But it's just a worm that gets into their food, and
it won't get into people.
No, it don't get into people. But anyway, then that is one of the things that by giving them a certain kind of worm medicine, why we could cure those worms. They'd kill those worms and they'd pass them out in their what they.
Yeah, how'd they get these worms?
Well, by eating decayed food and things of that nature.
And then it would get in their...
Get into their intestines. No, it gets in their intestines. They hang in their intestines. And they multiply in there. And in their dung, they do pass out some of them, but they still have others in there. So that is one of the things that we worked on the hog end of it, was worms.
And you could get rid of them.
Horses have them too, It's a different kind, but horses do have them too. And we used a different kind of preparation for horses. And also, if you keep your horse good and healthy and give him a bodybuilder, why, he'll take care of himself.
What's a bodybuilder?
Some kind of a, it's the same as a vitamin would be for our human. This company put out a stock food that, they put out several different kinds of stock foods that we used along those lines. Yeah.
What about the chickens? What kind of disease?
Well, they have the roup is one thing, and then they have mites, and they have lice in the. So you have to spray. You have to spray the nests and the roofs where they roost to keep those mites and lice off of them. Because if they get on there, they just they sap their vitality, and they don't lay good, and they just don't, and they don't fatten. So you, if they're chickens that you're going to fry, why, if they can't get good healthy fryers unless you take care of them with keep them free of insects and things of that nature.
What about plant insects or plant problems?
In those days, we heard very little about that. We never heard of spraying anything back there, like only a few apples and peaches and things like that. We did spray, but corn and alfalfa and wheat and oats and all that,
Did you ever hear of boll weevils?
Never heard of them in those days.
It was something that came later.
That came later.
What about the people? What kinds of illnesses did they have?
Well,
because you were in a position to know.
Yes, we had about the same things that they have now. But of course, heart disease was. I don't remember hearing much about heart disease. We had a disease back there. They called it consumption.
Would that be like slow fever? Or?
That's what we call tuberculosis now. But we had lots of people that would have that, and they'd linger on for months and months and finally die with what they call consumption. But I think that was a name that they had for it in those days, and we call it tuberculosis now. And they didn't know what to do for it. They didn't seem to have any cure for it. They just rested is about all they could do for it.
Would it take a whole family?
Well, it did sometimes. It would be communicative, and if one would die with it, why, they was all afraid of it, and sometimes they would have one or two in the family that one would get it from the other.
Did the other farmers help that family, or did they quarantine it?
No quarantine. They didn't quarantine for it at all. They just set up with this. We always, if anybody had sickness in the family, why, one family would go over and set up with them and take care of them, you know. And the same way, when people died, why, they just laid them out in the home, and they'd set up with the corpse. The farmers would go, I've done it many a time.
Was that for a religious reason?
No. It's just a custom that we had in that time. And We always, when anybody died in the community, we'd always, four or five men would go dig the grave for them in some cemetery around there. And very simple. Of course, they did have undertakers, all right, and they would supply the coffin, and they would come out and help bury it, but the men did all the work. The neighbors did all the work.
Did they have divorces in those days?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they had divorces in those days. Nothing like they do, not like they do now. It was kind of considered a terrible thing to get a divorce.
How did they do it?
Well, they went through a process of law like they do now, but just what it took to do it, I don't really remember that part of it, because I heard very little about it. And illegitimate children in those days was just something that was, that was just a terrible thing. They just didn't hear that, only seldom would you hear of anything like that.
How did people handle that? I know it must have happened.
Well, it did happen, but they just if the people didn't get married, why, they just took care of their daughter in the house and did the best they could. But it was considered a terrible calamity for something like that to happen in the neighborhood. And usually the people would eventually move out of the neighborhood, move clear away to where they wasn't known.
It just wasn't accepted.
It wasn't an accepted thing at all. That's right. It really wasn't. Yeah.
What about religion? Did people go to church back in those
days? Yes. Yes. We're very religious people. Most of those people were religious, and churches were everywhere. I was raised in a church right close to where we live. It is 2 miles and 3 quarters from our house to the church. And we were regular attenders. My father and mother belonged to it, and we grew up in church and Sunday school.
Have you ever heard of a church arbor or an arbor church?
Yes, I have. I've been to them.
What's that like?
Well, they go out in the woods and they cut down some trees and cut some limbs and put up there and throw the limbs with leaves on it. And they have a church right under that arbor out in the forest, out in the timber.
Is that during the summer?
Yes, in the summer. That's when they have, back in there they have what they call association meetings, and that's where several churches go together and hold a kind of a union meeting, and that's where they usually have such as that, is it? A meeting of that nature.
Did they have picnics and things like that?
Yes, they had picnics. And we had, in our little town, which was 6 miles from us, we had a little fair there every year, and they'd have...
So they had this little fair?
Yeah, that was a kind of a farm affair. The farmers all saved their best grain, a sample of their grain, and a sample of their corn, and melons, and watermelons, and cantaloupes, and... Then they had canned fruit. They had a canned fruit section, and they had a section where the ladies brought their needlework, and it was judged, and they offered prizes for it. And there was always a few racehorses in the country, and the boys would race them on Sundays, and they'd tune them up, and they'd have a few horse races. And they would have a balloon ascension, usually.
A balloon ascension?
A balloon ascension. That was where they filled the old balloon they built a fire under it. I guess they used coal oil or gasoline, and they got this thing full of hot air, and then they had a parachute hooked to it. And this balloon would go way up, and of course they always made quite a big show of it. Some man that was with the outfit, he'd say, "Oh, he can't get loose. That's, give me a gun. I got to shoot him loose." And they'd have a stir around there. Of course, we knew it was put on. And about that time, the old boy had cut loose, and he'd come down his parachute, and the old balloon had turned. They had a weight on the upside, and it had turned over then, and all the black smoke would go out, and the balloon would drop back to the earth, and the man had come down. And some of them had accidents and got killed, but I never did see one of them. But I remember also seeing the first airplane I ever saw was made out of bamboo, and the guy got it up for about a minute or two. That is all it ever...
What year was that?
Well, I don't just remember. That must have been about... 1914 or somewhere in there. I was about 14 years old then.
How did this guy that jumped out of the balloon, how did he dress?
Well, he didn't seem to have on anything else, only he usually had a white suit on so you could see him, see? That is the main thing. But when he get back down, I've seen him bring him back in, and of course that old black smoke, he would have his clothes pretty well smoked up by the time he got back, but you could see him. He usually wore white clothes, so you could see him up there.
Was it a modern-type parachute? Or?
Well, it wasn't the parachutes that we have now. It wasn't put in like that. he just hung down by it, and when he cut loose, why, it just opened. His weight just opened it. He had it tied with little cords or something that would just break open. And
he was taking quite a risk then.
Well, I guess so, but they always folded it. They folded this thing and put these little things on it to hold it that would just hold it in that position. So they always said, though, that the man that was going to do the jumping, he did his own folding. He got that parachute ready himself. And these farmers, then, they'd bring all this fruit in and get it judged, and they'd have the horse races, and they would have different kind of contests, boys races and barrel races and sack races. 1 foot, two of them would get their foot in a sack and run together, and it was quite a little affair. It lasted 3 days, and
it was something that you looked forward to.
Oh yes, yeah, it did. And I remember the first ice cream cone I ever saw was at that place, and they made it like you make a pancake. They made it on a little griddle, and they took a little thing then, picked it up, and rolled it into a little cone. And of course, one end of it is open, so as soon as they put the ice cream in it, it began to drip at the bottom. So you had to be a little careful with the ice cream. But that's the first ice cream cone I ever remember seeing.
Was it a brown cone?
Yeah, it was a brown cone. Yeah, that's right.
Well, is that... When you stayed with these farm families, did they play instruments at all in the evening?
Oh, sometimes. Sometimes they did. Yes, sometimes they did. And sometimes we played games in the evening. We'd play dominoes or something if it was something that didn't work too hard. Or sometimes you'd get out and it'd come a rain, you know. Maybe you'd stay all night with a man. Next morning it's raining, and you'd if he was a good customer or so, you wouldn't get out, and you'd just stay there for a half a day maybe. And we did whatever we could to pass away the time, like playing checkers or dominoes or something like that.
What about childbirth? Did people have problems with having children in those days?
Most of them in those days, a lot of them had what they call midwives. Our first child was born with a midwife. And she was just a neighbor of ours that my father went and got her about 2 miles away, and she came there and stayed till the child was born, and she took care of the whole thing. But of course the doctors then, in later years, they had some doctors too.
What were the doctors like?
Well, they were general practitioners. They'd go in a horse and buggy. They'd drive out to your place in a horse and buggy to see you. And if they had an epidemic, like sometimes they did have, why...
What kind of epidemic?
Well, the flu, for one. Typhoid fever was another. And they'd just drive from one house to another in their buggy with their pill bag, and they'd give you some pills and look you over. But anyway, they'd go far and there with that horse and buggy, come to see you 8 or 10 miles out in the country and drive their own... And some of them employed liver stable men to drive them out, especially if it is at night. And I remember one time we had to get a veterinary from 21 miles, and he come out in the night, and we put a lantern up in a tree because we didn't know whether he could see our place or not. And we put that lantern up so he could tell when he could see our place and come to it. It was some of it was pretty crude, all right, in those days, but they got along with it. I remember one time I rode a horse 6 miles to town to get my tooth pulled, and they pulled it out, and I got on the horse and rode back home 6 miles.
Was it a dentist that pulled it?
No, it was a doctor.
Doctor.
It was just a doctor. He just got me back in the back of his office and set me down and pulled it out. And the boy was pretty...
Did he give me anything for the pain?
I don't think he gave me anything. I think he just pulled it out of there.
Was it a front tooth or a back tooth?
No, it was a jaw tooth. And I know I had a friend, and he saw me there. And he come in and kind of helped me down. He helped the dentist do the... He wasn't a dentist. He's just a doctor. And old Dr. Snodgrass, I remember him well. He just pulled that tooth out.
Dr. Snodgrass?
Snodgrass, yeah.
Snodgrass.
Yeah. And I had my own pony. I had a famous pony that I rode all my life till I was grown. And that was old Dexter. I rode him to school, 6 miles to a school, high school. And I courted my wife on him. I'd drive him to the buggy. I'd ride him to the liver stable and rent the buggy for a quarter. And I'd put the harness on old Dexter and go out to see my girlfriend. And then I'd take the buggy back and leave it in the liver stable and saddle my horse and ride home. And after we was married, we went to parties and my wife would ride in the saddle with me and I'd carry our baby daughter in my arm. And we'd go to parties on old Dexter.
On old Dexter.
He was a wonderful horse.
Do you remember asking your wife's parents if you could marry her?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't. We eloped. I was in the Navy, and I came home on the train from the Navy. She met me at the train station, and we got on another train and went to the adjoining county seat and got married.
Just like that. Huh?
Just like that. Yeah, I was married in a Navy uniform.
What was the marriage ceremony like?
Oh, we just went to a justice of the peace, and his wife was one of the witnesses, and I think there was two or three witnesses there that she got, and we just had a little simple wedding there in the justice of the peace's house.
Do you remember how much it cost you for the license?
No, I don't. But must have been practically nothing. Might have been a dollar. Very small fee, anyway. I'm sure of that.
You said the judge asked you something?
Asked me.
The judge asked my wife something, but...
How old I was, and I said 18, I guess.
Yeah, she said 18, I guess. And he says, you guess? And she says, yes, I'm 18.
How old was she?
18. She just liked a few days being 18, really.
This is session 2, tape 1 of an interview with Clarence W. Graham for the California State College Bakersfield California Odyssey Project by Michael Neely at 755 Valencia Street, Lindsay, California, 93247, on March 23, 1981 at 9 a.m. Well, now, last time we had covered the period of time up to about when you came to California. That was in 1924?
That's right. That's right.
And then when you came in 1924, were there a lot of other people who had come from Oklahoma or that area?
Well, they were a lot of people here from all those Midwest states, all right, but it seemed like in the next 5 or 6 years, there was many, many more came than were here at that time. And of course, that was the time that Steinbeck wrote about the Grapes of Wrath. And
you read that book?
Yes, I read that book, and also Mice and Men, or Men and Mice, which is it, one way or the other, anyway. And the people, a lot of them, camped or set up housekeeping in any way they could along down the Kern River near Bakersfield, and some of the ditches down there, I know that they set up there. Now, I never did go right down to see those camps where they were camping, but I talked to a lot of people that did, and I also... some of our church organizations around this country and the relief people gathered up food and blankets and quilts and stuff of that nature and took it down there to help those people. I know that that happened all right.
When did they really start coming out here?
Well, it seemed to me like it is in around the 30s, the 30s and on up, 30 to 35 was main time right in there.
And so at that time you were working in the post office?
Yes, yes. And it seemed awful hard to get a job then. There's a lot of people that
would just practically work for anything. I know we had a man come to our house right here down in, on Denver Street in Lindsay, and he wasn't begging, he was looking for work. And I said, well, mister, I just don't have anything. I'd come home from lunch that day, and he'd come by. I said, I don't have anything. He said, oh, couldn't you just let me cut some weeds or something? He says, I'll do anything to get a dollar or so to get me something to eat. So I said, well, we had a fence row there, and of course I could have done it in probably an hour or two myself and would have done it, but I said, well, I don't have any money really to pay you for such work, but I said, you go ahead and cut that out and I'll give you a dollar and a half. So I just gave it to him, and he did all right and went on his way. But that was typical. There was just a lot of people that just couldn't find work, that's all. It was kind of a critical stage in the history of this country, all right.
Would you say those people were deadbeats?
No, they weren't deadbeats. No, sir. They might have, of course, you know, there's always a bad apple in every barrel of apples, but they might have been some deadbeats in those, but a lot of those people were sincere. They wanted to work, and they would work. And people had hired a lot of them on these ranches around here, said they worked good, and they made them good hands. It was conscientious, yes.
Did they keep their word when they gave it?
Well, I don't know about that, but it seemed that they were upright people, trying to get along. They were just in desperation, and I would say they were just doing the best they could.
Did they come to the post office where you were working?
Oh yes, yeah. We had a tremendous general delivery in those days. They all got their mail general delivery.
How did they dress?
Well, some of them pretty poor. Yeah, they did. Some of them looked pretty ratty.
They look hungry?
Well, some of them, yes. Yeah, that's right. And I know that they did go around to the stores here, some organizations, and asked the stores to give them a sack of potatoes or something to take down there to those people.
To share with other people?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you ever see one of the camps where they were living?
No, I never did. I never did go down there. Of course, I was working every day, and I just never had a chance to get down there to see them.
Did their presence at the camp create problems in the community?
Well, I guess so. From some reports that I heard, their sanitary conditions got out of control, you know. They just had little old privies along the river banks, and it created quite a commotion, all right, all around for the people that were trying to help them and trying to look after the sanitary facilities. Did.
What were they able to do? What were the people able to do to help them?
Well, I just really don't know. It just kind of, over a period of time, they just kind of worked it out. They almost ordered them off of the place, but they had nowhere to go. But as fast as they could, well, they moved on and found jobs or found old shacks to live in better, and they finally cleared them out, got them off of those ditch banks down there.
Did any of them settle in this community?
Oh, sure. Lots of them settled in this country. A lot of them became fruit tramps. They followed the fruit. They'd come through this country, and they'd pick the oranges, and they'd go on right on north, and they'd pick cherries up around Stockton and Sacramento, and then they'd go to Watsonville and pick apples and work their way on into Oregon and Washington for more apples and peaches, and up around Yuba City. There were a lot of them went to Yuba City because they raise a tremendous amount of peaches around Yuba City. And some of the big canneries there, they worked in the fields and in the canneries. Yeah.
But some of them did actually stay.
Yes, oh yeah, they some of them would get a permanent job on the ranch by the month. They paid them about $75 or $80 a month on the ranch and furnished them a house. And that was, they got along good on that.
Did the ones who stayed become good members of the community?
Well, some of them did. Yeah, a lot of them did. A lot of them made them good, substantial citizens. And worked for several years for the same man and made a good deal all the way around, both ways.
Do you know any of those people today?
Well, no, I don't know that I do. I know some of them that's dead now, all right, but one of them in particular I remember came out here, and his wife is in the rest home at Porterville now, and they were real poor folks, and they got in and worked for a man and later bought a little grove, and when he finally passed away, they were real well up in the money. And of course, they let liquor in later years. The reason we know this family so well is my wife worked in the packing houses, and she worked with this lady. And so they worked in the grape houses out here, and she was a forelady. But we went to see her here just not too many months ago, and she's in a rest home in Porterville now. But they came out and made good money and worked along and got a man that really helped them. And then in later years, though, when they got up in the money, they let drink get a hold of them, and it kind of ruined them. And he died rather early in life. And they've had they had a grandson. It seemed like that family was just luck was against them. They had a grandson, and he dived in the river up by Springville and broke his neck and killed him. And just here not too long ago, a boy that had a car wreck and killed himself.
Well, how would you compare the Mexican workers in that period with the people from Oklahoma in that era?
Well, of course, at that time, we didn't have too many Mexican people in this country. Later on, though, of course, the Mexican people come in, and of course, I remember the Bracero program real well. I've been to both ends of that. They came into this country and worked. And I've been to where they gathered them up in Mexico, and saw thousands of them waiting there to try to get to the United States legally. I mean, they was processing them and bringing them to this country. But the Mexicans made good laborers too in the fields here.
What other groups did they have in this area at that time? They had the people, the migrants from Oklahoma and that area, and then they had they didn't have Mexican workers?
Not too many. When we first started, they didn't have too many Mexicans. But of course now, we've got about half of our population's Mexicans now.
What about other groups, other ethnic groups?
Well, of course, the Japanese people came in here, you know, and settled, and they became growers and vegetable raisers of vegetable and produce and all of that. And of course then when we had the war, we had to put them all in the intern camps. I just read an article in the paper this morning about it, and by that time I was assistant postmaster when that happened, and I fingerprinted all the ever Japanese in this country. My postmaster and I, we worked for about 3 days and nights. We'd hold a session after dinner or supper, whatever you want to call it, and for the ones that couldn't get in the daytime, and that's what we did. We filled out a form, and then I fingerprinted them.
What kind of people were they?
Well, they were, those people were nice people. They realized that they were in a tough spot, and a lot of them, I don't think we had a man that ever had any idea of doing anything against the United States government. But the law said to do it, and we put them in internment camps, and they were stationed over here at the Tulare County Fairground and built old tar paper buildings and give a little hut to each family. And then they put guards around them, you know, they was guarded, they were just like prisoners. And it was a sad thing, and we had lots of people here. At that time, a lot of these people had substantial amounts of money in the postal savings here. And years after that, after they got out of the out of those camps and were stationed around, why, it fell my lot to try to find them, because they had this money here and we owed them interest, and it was quite a little deal to find them. But of course, finally they did away with the postal savings altogether, and they got all that money back to them.
Well, times weren't hard during the 30s for just the migrants. They were hard for everyone in the community.
Oh, yes. Yes, they were. And even people that sold out back in and got out of that Dust Bowl country and back in the Midwest, they'd farmed and hadn't had a crop for a good many years. They came out here practically broke, same as I did. I was the same way. I came out here broke, practically. And they came out here, but so there was a lot of relief work for not only for everybody, but just people that had got out here and got a little job, and then they'd had hard luck, you know, and maybe sickness in the family, or a man that had come out here and then he got sick and wasn't able to make a living, and they churches met and made quilts, and we brought cans of food and stuff like that to take out to these poor families. And that was not only people from Oklahoma, but they came from Missouri and Kansas and all over the Midwest at that time.
Well, would you say that they were treated fairly when they came out here? They were treated fairly by the people in the community?
Oh, I think so. I think so. They was... A lot of them were good, honest people, you know, and wanted to do the right thing, and they just seemed like their health, their luck was against them, and but they was taken care of as best they could in those days. Of course, we didn't have all the relief programs that we have now in those days. I can remember my father and mother, my wife's father and mother. They got pretty well down and out after coming out here and staying for a good many years. Of course, they got old, and they didn't have any, there was no old age pension at that time, and we had to take them to different hospitals, especially the mother, and it was quite a problem, yeah. And I finally... my father-in-law bought a lot down here and always wanted to put a house on it. And then he never did get it on there. So finally, when he got to where he wasn't able to work and he wasn't able to make a living, and they did start this old age pension about that time. I said, "Well, Dad, if you'll deed me that lot, I found a house that I can buy and I'll put it on that lot. And you can live in it as long as you live. And then when you pass away, why, I'll do whatever I want to do with the house." So I did. I bought a little house down here for $600 and had it moved on the lot, and they lived there as long as they lived. Of course, I never charged them any rent, but one time it was kind of a peculiar situation. We built a porch on the little house, and as soon as we did that, why, the county assessor, the next time I paid my taxes, why, I got a raise in taxes, and me had given them the house, you know. So I went over, and they had this relief going pretty good by that time, and I went over to the Visalia, And I knew the man. His aunt lived here in Lindsay, and I knew her through the post office. And he was in charge of part of that stuff then. So I went over there, and I told him about this deal. I said, now here I am giving this old couple a house to live in and trying to make it as comfortable for them as I can. And I said, I built a little porch on there, and you hiked my taxes up. And he said, well, why don't you charge them rent? He said, we could pay you rent on that house. And I said, well, I said they'd probably throw up their hands if I charged them rent. He said, well, you won't have to. We'll pay the rent. And I said, well, since my taxes went up, that sounds like a pretty good deal. So we charged them $30 a month rent. And it was a two-bedroom house, and it's a good house. And so, of course, he said, well, now, the only way we can do this, we have to put it in their check. And he says, if you don't take it out of them, why, then you'll be liable to that you didn't go through on the agreement. So the folks couldn't. Of course, they got that $30 extra, you know. And of course, by that time, while we was buying all their groceries and doing their shopping, but they, especially the mother, she didn't understand that we. She said, "Well, I didn't know we was ever going to have to pay rent on this." Well, of course, she didn't, but. But we give them lots of money, and we probably give them more back than their rent. But we did take it out every time. We did just like we were supposed to do, but in a roundabout way, while we probably give it back to them. Did a little scheming, yeah, that's right.
Well, now, looking back on your life, how have things been, just in general? I mean, are you satisfied with the way your life?
I'm more than satisfied. I'm more than satisfied. I thank the Lord every day for my blessings. And I don't understand it hardly. When we started out to, when we retired, my pension was $330 a month. And we traveled for a good many years on that. And we did it on $300 a month. That was $10 a day. And we did it religiously, and we went to all over the country. We didn't, neither one drank or smoke, and we didn't buy expensive clothes and a lot of things like that. But we went to New York, went to the Yankee Stadium to see the old timers game at Yankee Stadium, and we did a lot of things that we wanted to do, and we did it on $300 a month. And my pension now is well over $1,000 a month. And by saving my money and investing, I'm doing real well now. I can't hardly believe it myself, really.
But you feel that coming to California was a good...
Oh, I definitely. It was definitely a turning point in my life, in every way, not only financially, but I think I changed my living habits. And I wasn't doing very good in Oklahoma. I was associating with a bunch. I never was a boy to drink or gamble or smoke or do that, but I wasn't living the right kind of a life, really. Playing Sunday baseball, got my leg broke playing Sunday baseball. My wife had to nurse me back to health at that. Of course, it didn't take the leg long to heal back up. But we turned over a new leaf when we come to California, really. Not church-wise, we didn't join the church or anything like that for several years, but my father, her father and mother were very devout church members. And of course, we naturally fell in with a different crowd when we came to California. And it paid out for us real good. And we have been active in the church now for over 50 years. And I am a deacon in the Primitive Baptist Church here. And I feel like that we're trying to serve the Lord now in an acceptable manner.
This has nothing to do with Oklahoma or being a migrant, but it seems to me in talking to older people, and you're how old now?
I'm 81. We're both 81.
That it seems that one of the, especially with someone like yourself who enjoys life so much, that's one of the problems of aging is realizing that at some point that has to stop.
Oh, yes, that's right. It will have to stop some of these days. But we're still real active, and my wife and I are both past 81, and we've been married over 62 years. But we're still strong, and we're looking forward to some more trips with that trailer out there, and I've got a good pickup out there sitting in there to pull it with. And of course, the cost of gas going up and all that, but we'll still make some trips and enjoy a few more years anyway, I'm sure.
You're quite a person, Mr. Graham. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, I've enjoyed doing it. It's been a pleasure to me to relate some of these experiences in my life.